Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
How's your quarantine life going?
It's going all right. The days all kind of blend together. So
yeah, Friday. Today's Friday.
Yeah, I was sending Calendar. In a piece for Calendar. Calendar knows no quarantine, no quarantine.
Now we're all seeing just how Calendar cannot be limited by time and space, despite being a calendar.
Right.
God.
Perhaps this was all a ploy of Calendar's.
You're going to tell me about your Macworld column. I literally forgot to write a Macworld column this week because Todoist stopped for some reason showing it as a to-do. And if I don't have it on my calendar or in my to-do list, I don't do it. And I actually texted Roman and I said, totally fell off my calendar this week. Do you want one today or should I just come back next Tuesday? And he said, just come back next Tuesday. So I got the week off.
week off.
I think literally for the first time in years, I didn't write a Macworld column this week, but I wrote one last Thursday. So consider it just whatever. So what was yours?
I was just saying it was actually not the Macworld column. I was writing another piece that I was sending.
Damn it, Dan.
Sorry. But it's fine. But I was saying sorry, this came in late. It's for a book related blog post that's going up next week. And it's like, sorry, this is coming in late, but this week. Well, it was a lot like all the other weeks lately. part of it was that I had a touch of, I mentioned this last week. I was having some RSI issues.
Yes.
With my wrist. And so I did buy and attach a keyboard tray to my desk, which is pretty good. The biggest problem I've had with it is that it added enough weight. So my desk is a sit-stand desk, but it's a manual one. So it's got like a handbrake. And you can adjust the tension in the this is going to get beyond me quickly mechanically, but essentially the tension that lets you control how smoothly sort of the desk goes up and down, because there's some like bolts that you can tighten or loosen depending on how much weight you have on the desk. And so now the desk is much heavier, and so it's a lot harder to raise it to the standing position.
Oh, interesting.
So I need to adjust those bolts to reduce or add tension, one of those. But the problem is I can only adjust them. You can only get at them when the desk is all the way up. So, and I had wrist problems. So I was like telling my wife, like, I need you for 5 minutes at some point so that you can help me lift the desk all the way up. So then I can adjust the bolts. So then I can actually move it up and down without requiring two people. Haven't gotten there yet, but it'll happen. That's been my most exciting thing of the week, I think.
That sounds just very dramatic and exciting.
Just very dramatic. Very dramatic.
And but increases nice. Tension or does it reduce tension?
Yes, that's right. The denouement will be, it'll wrap it all up, as it were. But now it's an adjustment to the workspace. Currently, I've also got my trackpad on the left side here because I'm trying to not use my right hand as much, which is annoying when you're doing things. There are so many things. Honestly, using the computer is fine. It's always like a little bit of a like, oh, yeah, this is a little weird. Typing and writing things, not a big deal. The biggest thing was editing podcasts because muscle memory was so bad for because I'm used to using moving my right hand with the trackpad to pan around and stuff, and then using the left hand on the keyboard to make cuts and drag stuff over. And my left hand just constantly wants to do the keyboard stuff, and it's trying to do it on the trackpad.
Do that.
And I'll be like, touch that. Like, no, there's no keys here. What's happening? And then I'll try to move my left hand over to the keyboard and then be like, now what's my right hand doing? It is useless.
Yeah. I think
been a problem.
One of the reasons that I started using Ferrite and the Apple Pencil and editing podcasts, editing The Incomparable on my iPad was that I was having, so I've had an unorthodox approach to typing since I was a kid. I learned to type really fast, entering computer programs from a computer magazine into my first computer I had, so self-taught, and I type fast, but I type in an unorthodox fashion. And I've always thought ergonomics has been weird for me. I very rarely have had any kind of RSI kind of issues, although I do, as I've gotten older, I do occasionally get a feeling of my wrist is really unhappy. And I've been experimenting. When I got my new desk, I went back to a keyboard tray, which I had avoided for a while. I didn't like the old keyboard tray, so I ended up raising my desk and raising my iMac and using the top of the desk as the keyboard, and that wasn't really great. So I went back with this new desk to a keyboard tray, and it's adjustable in a bunch of different ways, and I love this keyboard tray.
Yep. Yeah, but, same one here. That's nice.
Part of my challenge is that I've got the keyboard and I've got the trackpad, and I use the Magic Trackpad. And first off, my keyboard and my Magic Trackpad are different heights, so that's a little bit weird. And second, and this is a really funny thing, I discovered that they, how can I put this? They were drifting on the desk. On the tray.
Oh, yeah.
Because they were not, even though they've got like little feet on them, basically the little feet were useless and they were sort of sliding. And I realized that I was having a huge problem with ergonomics, and it was making me sore and parts of my hands and shoulders and all that hurt. And I realized it was because I was contorting myself, because even though I can adjust my iMac to be anywhere, I was... The keyboard was sliding around, or the tray had been knocked askew, and so the iMac's over here and the keys are over here, and I end up in this really weird position. And so I actually bought silicone stickers, a whole pack of them, and I washed off the bottom of my keyboard and my trackpad, and I washed the keyboard tray and all of that, because it was a little dusty, a little dirty, and I put these new silicone stickers on, because the little feet that were on these things were just not strong enough, even when clean. And now they basically, it's like they're stuck with like a sticker, but they're not. You can just lift it up and move it. And that's been huge, because now they don't drift, and my body knows exactly where they are, and I can set my iMac and I can kind of get it. But I think in one of those moments where I was feeling like in my wrist, a little tightness, that I started doing the iPad podcast editing. And the reason is, and if anybody's ever used Logic, they'll know this, but I've found, and there are probably other apps that are like this that different people use. Photoshop is a little bit like this, but for me, Logic was the app where I would spend the most time, like extended periods of time, doing incredibly detailed mouse movements and clicks and drags. And like where you're, I mean, I can feel it, even describing it, I'm doing it. And it's like, and my entire arm and wrist would be like tense, because you have to get, it's precise, and you need to have
precision.
Everything be.
That's what it gets it.
And, and at some point I out of kind of desperation, I edited a podcast using the Apple Pencil and Ferrite, which I'd meant to do anyway. And I thought, oh, this is way better ergonomically, just vastly superior ergonomically. And that's why I still use Logic a lot, but that is why for Incomparable, at least, which is the one podcast that I actually do a detailed edit job on every week. One, I don't even bother doing it with the trackpad and the keyboard anymore.
Yeah, I've still only briefly used Ferrite. I've done one or two episodes on it here and there, and it's just, I haven't taken the time to like essentially just retrain my brain and just be like, I'm going to commit to using this, and I will, you know, adapt to it and figure it out, and it'll take me a little time, but like, you know,
works
2 weeks from now,
I'll
be fine.
Trackpad now too.
Does that get me back around to the same problem as with Logic?
Yeah,
I don't know.
It does. It does actually. Yeah. Exactly. But
I only have a few shows that I do like super detailed edits on, so it's not a big deal.
Yeah,
but
most.
Yeah,
I'm writing about this now for a project that I'm working on, but most of the shows that I edit, and I think that you edit, are what I call, it's not quite live to tape, because that's like what Dave Hamilton does with the Mac Observer stuff, where he's literally like got a radio set up where he's feeding in the audio and everything, and you press record, you do the show, play the music out, press stop, and then that's your file. I don't do that, but I think a lot of us have this kind of like cleanup edit, which is basically you cut the head and the end off, right? So it's when you, not when you press record, but when you start, and not when you press record to turn it off, but when you end. And then
so
you
like
put
a package,
and then you put music. If you've got music, you put the music there. And then if you, and the other thing I would put in is if something catastrophic happened in the middle that you need to snip out, you probably wrote it down or something, you snip that out and you're done. You're not like prowling the file for fixes.
Right.
Like, and it's a spectrum, but like my most common scenario for everything, like other than the Incomparable, is that, which is like for TV Talk Machine back in the day with Tim Goodman, we did that on a weekday afternoon, and my son would often come home during the podcast, and so the garage door opener would just come on, and I'm in the garage, like literally, it was just like, oh boy. And so I would write down like 32 minutes, trim the garage door opener out. But like that was it, like head and end, music, any catastrophic bits in the middle, and then you're done.
The closest I have to that, I think, is Biff, show I do with John Moulton, Guy English, where I slap stuff on the beginning and the ending, and then we have like a couple segments, so I'll put chapter markers, and there's like a little sound effect that goes with it. But unless somebody has screwed something up, you know, I'm not editing in the middle, unless usually it's because one of them swore, and I'm like, I'm just going to go in and trim that bit out, or I need to like glue something together. But yeah,
but
it's pretty
clockwise
basic.
And the incomparable, it's a different story. And to a little lesser extent, I don't edit Upgrade, but when I do, it also falls in this category.
And the Rebound for me is super detailed for some reason.
Yeah, well, and it's the more people you've got too, the more you need to do it. Yeah. But that. Then you're really in there, and it can be really intense. And that was when I started to feel it. Combined with the fact that my peripherals, my input devices, were drifting all over the keyboard tray, which was super frustrating.
Right.
So I highly recommend.
Yeah, it's stuff
the silicone stickers. Not only can you stick them on your cabinet doors and stuff so that they don't slam loudly, which I also highly recommend, but you can stick them on the bottom of your stuff so it doesn't slide across your desk. And
that's smart.
That's
like
awesome.
That. I like that. Yeah, I so far so good with the keyboard tray. The biggest issue for me is just also accommodating to being like slightly farther away from the computer.
Yeah,
I'm used to being right up on the desk, and this actually pushes me back a bit, which is probably fine. But it's just an adjustment to figuring it out. But
that's been my challenge with the iMac positioning too. It's the same thing. I've got it on an arm, so it's really easy to do. But there is that question of like, I want to be up against the desk. Years of training have put me up against the desk, and I have to remind myself. The thing that I'm noticing lately is I have to remind myself to pull the keyboard tray out a little more, because I reach up for the function keys and I'm like hitting the underside of the keyboard tray thing, and it's like, oh no, just pull it back further. You don't need to be all the way forward. And in my case, I can literally pull the iMac closer if I want it closer, and push it away. And honestly, a 27-inch iMac is so huge that I probably don't want it closer. Because then I can't even see the edges of the screen. And I have found that too, window placement on the big iMac, where I've got something off. I'm like looking at Twitterific, and it's off on the right side of the screen, which is usually where I leave it. And I'm like, why am I reading an entire tweet thread all the way over there on the, like, it's,
yeah,
this
right.
is ridiculous. Let's move it to the center, because it's such a huge screen. It's just ridiculous.
Yeah, no, it is an adaptation, just trying to figure out how to set up your workspace. And I spend part of it, I think a big part of why this triggered for me as a problem with my arm was just I used to go out in the morning and spend a couple hours in the coffee shop, you know, on my laptop or the iPad. And then come back, and like then in the afternoon, I'd spend a few hours in the office. And now it's like 9 to 5 in the office.
You're in the same position.
Same muscles. I've switched to, I'm moving like to the, like in the morning, you know, I'll get up and then I'll do some work before I like take my shower and get dressed. And so I'll work on the couch and work on the laptop or the iPad for a little while and then take a break and then come back after lunch and sit at the computer so I can try and reduce that.
That's why I did my, plus I think it actually offers a mental break, but that's also one of the reasons that I did my, you know, writing at the iPad at the bar in my kitchen is just to be in a different position, and that's a standing position too, so I don't even have to adjust this desk into standing position. I just go somewhere else and stand.
Right Or for me, or for you, sitting like when it's nice out, I can sit on the porch in front of my house and do some writing in a chair
there,
and you'll sit in the tree. Exactly. So yeah, it's nice to certainly, I think, this shifting mental gear space, like it's a lot harder for me to do fiction writing. I don't write fiction on the iMac. Just don't.
Interesting.
And I don't know why. Maybe it's just from years and years and years of doing it on my laptop when I only had a laptop or stuff like that. But or when the laptop was really like kind of my work machine back in the Macworld days.
But and there's some truth in that it's the you're creating kind of a different mental space when you shift to a different thing. And that can be good if you need a break, if you need a change of pace. But it can also be like a cue for me. For me, for a long time, a little bit less now, but for years, when I was doing NaNoWriMo especially, putting headphones in and being on my laptop, and this is before I had an office out here, that was crank away at the words.
Right, sure,
like, those two things happened, then I was just completely focused. And to this day, I sometimes, when I'm struggling with writing, I will put in my headphones, even though I'm out here by myself and I've got speakers and all of that, I'll put in my headphones, and it works. Like
there's a psychosomatic thing there almost, when it's like if it like encloses you or something, or just like I'm with you, because I yesterday I was having a bear of a time coming up with my Macworld column, And I went so far as to, like, this is the procrastination level of, like, I should write a column, but I'm having trouble focusing. I should try out one of those apps that shuts down everything else on my computer to see if that actually helps me focus. So then I spent, like 20 minutes looking at all those different options. And I tried one out for a little bit, and it turned out, like, okay, this was not... I like the end effect, but at the same time, this is more about me having the willpower not to look at other stuff than it is needing that to be enforced by an external place. But it was sort of a similar point of the, like, I need some sort of cue to remind me that this is the time to focus on this task without getting distracted by all this other stuff.
So, I mean, we're talking to a bunch of people who are probably in unusual work circumstances right now. If you, if you're working and working from home, it's worth thinking about if you haven't done this already, is think about, like, what are your context. So CGP Gray did a video. You can go find it. Popular YouTuber CGP Gray. And who we know, of course. Gray did a video about, it's like called Spaceship U. And the idea at its core, it's a good video, people should watch it, is in these times where you may be isolated and you're limited with your work and all of those things, he says the key thing to focus on is, in his mind, it's create spaces for contexts. And what he's really saying is create a workspace, create an entertainment space, create a sleep space, and create an exercise space. And don't let them be the same space.
Yeah.
Because then you don't have a context. And the place where you work is the place where you sleep. And that means when you try to go to sleep, your brain's not going to let you, because that's also the place where you work. And that's also the place where you watch videos. So instead of working, you'll watch videos. And then instead of sleeping, you'll watch videos. And I think, you know, it's a very specific thing. It's not going to apply to everybody. But I think the truth of it is carving out a space, if you can, and a context. Mike and I did a thing. We had a listener. I think it was Mike. It might have been, was it David Sparks maybe instead? Anyway, there was some podcast listener wrote in to a podcast I was on and pointed out that he had a foldable table. I think he lived in Paris. It was either Paris or London, but it was a very large, dense city. And he had a table. He had a very tiny apartment. He had a foldable table. And every morning, he would unfold the table and put a chair next to it, and that was his workspace. And at the end of the day, he would fold up the table and put it away, and then he would... And I know that seems kind of weird, but it's all... And, you know, it's also probably a necessity, but what he said was, contextually, he knew he was at work when the table was there. And I know that, yes, we can do our working and eating and sleeping and entertainment all in the same exact place, but our brains really do take a lot of cues from context. And so I think it's worth thinking about that. Like, can I make a space, a context of some kind for when I need to be productive, and only use it when I need to be productive, just to get myself in that same frame of mind. So if you're out there listening and you haven't tried this, maybe try it. I mean, maybe try to find a place. It could even be like, not this side. Like, I edit podcasts on the iPad on the side of our big couch that's right by the TV. So it's the worst place to watch TV. And so I never sit there, but I do my editing there, and I have created a little context cue, which is, this is where I sit when I'm going to get down to business and edit the podcast. And like, it could be as simple as, like, this cushion of the couch is the work cushion. It's anyway, I mean, people, we're not breaking any news here, but I definitely encourage people to give it a try, because it's so true that we all take cues about stuff like that in terms of getting into work mode or not, or out of work mode, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I think it does make a big difference in terms of just, like, being able to focus on specific tasks, just having something, whether it's putting the headphones on or finding a space or using a specific device, like, that sort of triggers those switches. I think it makes a big difference.
Even using a different keyboard, like, what if you've got a little workspace and you've got a little, you know, you've got one keyboard. What if you plugged in a different keyboard? would that be different?
I don't know.
It might.
Maybe for you.
I got my keyboard on here now. I don't know.
Everybody's a little different in that way. Yeah. Like, there's definitely
it's just got to be meaningful to you, right?
Exactly. Anyways, I wish there was a little, now we're all limited in our context, and it's hard to carve out those new ones.
Yeah, because the cafe was a great context for you.
It's really great. It's really good. That's like going to be the last one to come back.
I wrote my Macworld column at Starbucks a lot of the time, and I just, forget that. That's never happening again. I got, so right next to me, in fact, I have the 13-inch MacBook Pro with a scissor switch keyboard.
That's how they, that's not the name. Not with MacBook Pro with Retina display. MacBook Pro with scissors switch keyboard.
No, it's MacBook Pro.
But we all know.
Four ports. And this was my kind of rant.
Two ports bad.
Two ports is fine. It's pointless. It's kind of pointless. It's the legacy, you know, is this right or not? This is my theory. My theory is that this is the legacy of the MacBook Air being replaced by the MacBook and the MacBook Escape, the no touch bar originally 13-inch, which they even then they called it two Thunderbolt ports. It was always the two Thunderbolt port 13-inch MacBook Pro, but like they're like, oh, these could be Air replacements, and they weren't, and people kept buying the Air, and they finally had to make an Air because people were just not buying them, and that was a misstep that I think is still, we're still basically in the same laptop generation, even though they fixed the keyboard and stuff, you know, that two-port laptop, they didn't send it to me. They didn't update the processors in it because they did it last year. All they did was put the keyboard and change
and
the...
double the storage.
Change the default storage. That's it. And that's fine. But I look at the Air, which is really good, and it's $999. And it's really good. And for most people, the base model of the Air for $999 is plenty. Like, it's plenty. It's not... And I see people saying, well, if you do video work or editing work, and it's like, I've edited.
If you're doing that, you're going on the high end, too. Well, like, if I've you really want it,
well,
you
this
go
is,
up.
This is my point. Is first off, I've edited big podcast audio projects and video projects on that MacBook Air, and it's fine. Plus, you can update it to a quad core if you want, although I've heard that the quad core, it definitely has to struggle with heat at times. It's blowing the fans really hard, and maybe the quad core is overkill for it. But like, even on the lower end of doing HD video editing and audio editing, it's still fine. But if you're so concerned about performance, I think you should get the 4-port 13-inch.
Like, I mean, why would that mid step up? Yeah, I'm with you. It doesn't make any sense to like to take a half step to that lower end 13-inch.
I just don't think it's a good value. I think I don't think anybody who would not buy an Air because it's not strong enough, who has those kind of needs, it's a. I'm sure there are people, but to me, it feels like a really narrow chasm between the people who can get their job done on the Air and the people whose needs are so specific that they have to have the more power that the Pro offers, but don't have the money to get a, you know, and I know some people don't have the money, but really it's like, if you can save the money to buy the $1,799 or whatever, the base model 4-port MacBook Pro and use that for years, it's a better buy. It's a better deal. It's more powerful. It's got the 4 ports. It's like, if you really, really can't use an Air, and I get that that's a huge leap from $999 to $1,799, and even though there is a $1,299 Air, you know, Apple wants to have that price level in there. I get it. Somebody wrote in, and I think that they're exactly right, which is somebody who I think worked at an Apple store who said these are SUV buyers. These are four-wheel drive buyers. Mm. The people who buy the 13-inch two-port MacBook Pro, it's because buying a Pro instead of an Air makes them feel better. And what they said is they're never going to drive off-road, but they want the four-wheel drive. It's that kind of mentality. They're never going to use these features, but it makes them feel good and to buy it, and so they buy it. And that's probably why that product still exists. But as an advisor of people who might be buying tech products, I don't recommend the 2-port 13-inch Pro, because I think the Air is great, and then you've got the 4-port version, which is very good. And
it's an interesting, Apple has always struggled a little bit with there being collisions in its laptop, you know, sort of area, in terms of just when there are products that don't quite fit nicely in their little matrix. And I think they've struggled with that in a variety of different places over the years. I mean, they had trouble getting rid of the old MacBook Airs for a long time. The MacBook, when it was in the lineup, was, as you said, very tricky positionally because it was expensive, but it wasn't as powerful. And I think that you're right that it's too crowded. In some ways, like, really, the lineup should be, you know, the MacBook Air, those two high-end configurations of the 13-inch, and then the 16-inch MacBook Pro. And it's like, it's a pretty good range in there. And honestly, I think, as I wrote a bit in this week in my macro column about, I find that even that high-end 13-inch Air is interesting because there are changes in there, and they're not insubstantial, but they're also not hugely substantial, right? Like, it's a nice speed bump, but it's not like a huge major refresh that lineup. A lot of people had expected something more like when the Apple changed the 15-inch to the 16-inch last year. Right, like they were thinking, oh, you know, the 14-inch, you know, will be the same size roughly, but it'll have smaller bezels and a bigger panel, and you know, that'll come with some of these changes. And for whatever reason, Apple was not ready to do that. If they are in fact going to do that, and so what you end up with is stuff that looks very similar to last year's model. It just has some better performance in it.
Yeah.
And so I think that's interesting. I think it signals a potential sort of holding pattern for some reason. I don't know why. Like, there's a lot of theories, and the one I spin out there, of course, is the processor transition, because I'm never going to let that die.
No, I think the ARM transition is going to lead to Apple completely rethinking its product lines.
I would expect so. I mean, it's interesting, as I pointed out, like, I would not have thought that to necessarily be the first candidate, but it was also the first. The PowerBook changed into the MacBook Pro, and I believe that was the first of the PowerPC to Intel transition. That was the first computer to undergo that transition. So it's precedented. No reason they couldn't do it if they felt like they had the chips to do it. So I think you're right, though, that they're going to be rethinking a lot of these things, especially because it's going to be a graduated thing, right? Like, we, as we've discussed before, and as I think everybody agrees, it's not like, you know, come next year, they're going to be like, ah, we've taken the wraps off our entire new product line, all of which is now powered by our own Apple-made chips. It's not going to happen that way. They're going to announce a transition. They're going to transition some models, but it will just be over the course of, like, a year or two, because that's just how it works. You can't change them all overnight. It just doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
And certainly a 14-inch pro-level laptop, whatever they're going to call it, is a decent candidate for that. So maybe that's where that comes into play. But I think it was interesting.
I'm fascinated to think. So all the iPads have the same processor. That's not actually true, but they're all like a processor. The current one of the iPad Pro has its processor. That's the, A12Z.
Right.
But the way that they've done, like, all the iPhones have the same processor. And then the older models, the lower-end models, use the older version of the processor. But we're going through this transition where there's going to be a new processor. And there is no old processor. This is the thing. So this is one of the things about the ARM transition that I do wonder about, which is, how are they going to roll this out? And how do they differentiate between models? Or do they? And that's my real question. Like, is it possible? Because you can't, like, imagine, oh, well, we're going to have a bunch of different laptops. We're going to have a non-pro laptop, and we're going to have a pro laptop, and we're going to have small ones, and we're going to have big ones. Okay, fine. But how are they different if the chip's the same?
Right. Something like with the X and the Z designations, where maybe there's like, this one has more graphics cores or something? Like,
maybe that's the solution, is that this one has 4 or 6 cores, because, and this one has 12 cores or something like that.
Because the iPads, like, it's like there are chips, they'll introduce a new chip in, you know, the new phone, right? Like, it's the A14. And then when the new iPads get released, they'll be like, it's the A14X, right? It's like basically the same chip as in the iPhone, but it has maybe more cores or more graphics support or something like that. You could use that as a differentiator. I don't know. It's the only thing that they've done so far, because, right, like you're saying, I think, is besides mentioning cores, they're not going to talk about clock speeds. Like, they've never talked about clock speeds for any of their chips.
I can't imagine they will. So one way they could do it is that they could launch with consumer products, with the first ARM chip being a consumer chip. And it's in the laptops and it's in the iMac, let's say. And then the next year, with that under their belt, they say, we're going to do our pro products now. I'm one of those people who thinks you could not. You could just keep the pro products as Intel. But I think Apple looks at laptops and thinks these should all be ARM. I'm starting to just come around to that. Like, there's so many benefits. If they can run macOS on ARM, and ARM processors are so much better at running mobile devices than Intel's processors are, that's a direction they're going to go. So that's, they could wait a year. And so then they've got the whatever, A14M for the new ones,
right,
that are this year. And then the next year they do the A15M, and that's a pro level, much snazzier kind of thing. And then the year after that, they update those to the A16M, and the consumer models maybe get an A15, the previous year's chip, or a variation on the previous year's chip. But the other way they could go is they could just have a couple of variations, like the iPad is the A12X or Z.
Z, yeah.
They could just have it be that simple, where there's an A13 or an A14, I guess, that is on all these products, but that there are a couple of variations, the low-end Mac version and the high-end Mac version. I also wonder if they'll keep the A series branding, which they educated the market about. It makes me so mad that they use the mobile pro coprocessor as M, you know, M1.
Right, because can't use that now, yeah.
Because imagine coming out with an ARM Mac and saying it's got the brand new M1 processor in it, but they used it already, so I guess they aren't going to do that. Maybe it'll be an X.
Well, unless they rebrand the...
It's the 10-1.
They'll rebrand the whole thing. Who knows? I mean, they when they went from... I'm fascinated because when they went from, you know, Intel... This came up recently in discussion in some Slacks, and when they went from PowerPC to Intel, they went from the PowerBook to the MacBook Pro, and, you know, the iBook to the MacBook, etc. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, I remember how at the time, this is, again, people like to talk about Apple product names a lot. I mean, we've all, you know, the iPad obviously got a lot of flack when it came out, but it's become vernacular now, right? And nobody bats an eye at it anymore. And the same thing with the MacBook Pro. I think when it came out, we were like, MacBook Pro?
Yeah.
Like, well, that's a terrible... But, you know, it's been 15 years. No one thinks about that anymore.
iPhone 11 it's Pro Max.
Pro. Yeah, right, exactly. So, I mean, it makes me wonder. Like, that is an opportunity for them to reset some branding,
right,
potentially. And I don't know what that looks like, but... Who knows? I mean, they could if they wanted. That would let them free up, like, maybe there's a different chip letter series thing. I think, frankly, they'd love to get away from talking about chips altogether, honestly. But, like,
sure,
you know, but like, the same way, they're never going to publish they're never going to publish clock speeds because they don't want to get into that fight, right, where everybody's like, but the clock speeds on the Intel chips are this much.
But megahertz-myth kind of thing. But
exactly.
But
they don't want to deal with that.
They are, but the chips are an advantage, so they will talk about them because they're so good at them. So
they'll talk about performance. They'll say, like, does this well, right? Like,
exactly.
But they won't talk about the numbers because, I mean,
they'll talk about core count, and that's why they'll probably vary. If there's a difference between a MacBook and a MacBook Pro in this era, it'll be core count.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And I think it's the same way. I mean, even you pointed this out, I think, in the MacBook Pro piece, like, the new chips actually run at lower clock speeds.
Yeah, but they're more efficient because they're on a smaller process, a 10-nanometer process. And the rumor is that the new ARM chips for Macs are going to be on this new, 8-nanometer process? Is like 6-nanometer? I don't even know where it is. It's even tinier process, and that is a... That's a thing that Intel can't provide them, and they can go there, and it's more efficient, and it does more with less, essentially. So yeah, it's fascinating to think. I was talking to somebody about how Apple is getting to reinvent WWDC this year.
Mm-hmm,
but that's another thing that happened. They announced it's going to happen sort of later in June. And I like WWDC, but the fact is, as somebody who's been going to WWDC, and I calculated it, since the summer of 1995. Sorry, I have to go back.
I've been going.
I can't even say 2000. 1995. 25 years, Dan, going to WWDC, which is bananas. I cannot believe that. I was just a babe in the woods in the 90s when I went, and it was a very different thing now. But I will tell you, it has not evolved as much as you'd think in 25 years. And it really hasn't evolved much since Steve Jobs came back and they moved it to San Francisco. It's different. It is different in a lot of ways. There are more people at it. It's more diverse in every single metric than it used to be. But it's also far less interactive than it used to be. It used to be that there were Q&As at the end of every
session. Right, they killed the Q&A sessions.
There were feedback forums that were basically open mic to ask the people in a particular group at Apple questions, where you just go there at the end of the week, and it was the QuickTime team, and people just lined up, and for an hour, they just asked questions of the QuickTime team in public, right? All that is gone. All that has been gone. Now there's these labs that are like one-on-one and all that, and we'll see how they deal with that. But my point is, it is, for all the things that have changed, it is surprisingly similar to what was there 25 years ago. And so what I was doing is I was talking to somebody about this, and we both agreed, like, this is a good opportunity for Apple. Because in this terrible situation that we all find ourselves, Apple is forced to reinvent WWDC. Mm-hmm. And although I'm going to miss the old event, there's going to be stuff about this new WWDC. Don't get me wrong. There's going to be stuff that's going to be bad and frustrating.
Sure, yeah.
But there's going to be stuff that's going to be great and that they just never bothered to try because they had the way that they did it. And that's exciting because I think that they're going to find that stuff and that's going to be real. That's going to be a change agent. And I think the same goes for the Mac product line with ARM, that it allows them, like you said, to do when they went to PowerBook to MacBook and all that. It allows them to not necessarily, they don't have to change everything or anything, but it gives them the opportunity to, because especially since they're building the chips themselves, to decide what they want the levels to be. And it could be completely different from what we see now. And that's exciting because it's a full-on reset.
And I think what's good about it for Apple is, specifically for Apple as a company, is that they are an institution that prides themselves on things like innovation. And it's very easy for them to get stuck in their ways if there is not something that forces them to shake up. Like they can shake themselves up, but it's a lot harder to mandate that change, as you said, rather than for some reason having that change forced upon you. So with WWDC is a great example. Like you said, they're going to have to try a bunch of stuff. They're going to have to. They have to. And I think that's separate from the question of whether it will be good or not, as you said. But I think Apple tends to thrive under those kinds of scenarios where they have to kind of, you know, adapt on the fly and change stuff, because that is where historically they shine. Like they do good work when it comes to, we need to figure out a solution to this problem. And I think because as they've gotten bigger and bigger and bigger, it's harder, right? Like you can't turn a battleship on a dime, you know, and the opportunities
don't float, Dan.
They sink. It's bad. You can turn a submarine on a dime. But it is hard, right? Like, they have tens of thousands of employees.
Cut to submarine. Ping. Clunk. Sir, what was that? I think that was the time. All right, so go ahead.
Time to stop. The hunt for Red October 2 never happened for some reason. But, you know, I think it's a challenge that Apple always has to struggle with in and of itself is inertia, right? Like, they do well.
For sure.
They make a ton of money. They make a lot of great products. But when you have tens of thousands of employees, as opposed to maybe 20 years ago when they did not have that many and they were not in the same market position that they're in now, it was a lot easier to be quick thinking and change stuff and like try a bunch of things.
Apple absolutely has in its DNA this idea of trying to do better and be different. And, I'm sure Apple University teaches a whole course about that iPod Nano thing where they killed the iPod Mini, which was their most popular product, in order to bring an iPod Nano out. Like, be your own. And that's a great thing for any business to teach, is like, be your own replacement. Don't protect what you have, because somebody out there is going to build your replacement. So you need to build your replacement. Like, that's great stuff. That said, I absolutely sense at Apple, and not in the whole of Apple, but Apple's biggest weakness in the last couple of decades has been don't mess with success.
Right.
And I am looking at Eddie Q. Like, iTunes got so, and the App Store got so successful so fast, And like, there were so many problems with the App Store, and it took them years before they kind of moved it to Phil Schiller and said, oh yeah, this is kind of broken. And even though it makes money, it's bad. And like, that's the part, that's one of the parts of Apple that I think fails their own cultural test, which is a lot of times it, the, what did John Madden, the football coach, used to say, winning is a great deodorant. And, you know, billions of dollars pouring in is a great deodorant, and it makes it very hard for anybody to say, you know, the App Store stinks, because they're like, but look at my money, look at all the money I'm swimming around in, how could it be bad? And the answer is no, it's bad. You've got the money despite the fact that it's bad, but it's still bad, and you should strive to make it better. And I do think Apple sometimes has fallen in the trap of, why do we need to work on that? It's making lots of money.
Right, and there's a metric of better than, say, your competition, potentially, but not necessarily like the best you can do, right? Like, there's a lot of stuff where
also true.
Apple makes great products, and they're like, but look at Android. Better than Android is garbage, right? And I was like, yes, like, but it's you're still falling short of where you could be.
Exactly.
And I mean,
Your Honor, we make billions of dollars, and nobody does it better than us, so we don't need to do anything.
Like, yeah, well, you just sit back and relax. I mean, and there's risks, too, right? Like, I think you could argue that the butterfly keyboard was born out of a attempt to do something better than what they thought they had,
right?
And sure, you know, it doesn't always work, right? Like, sometimes you make a misstep, and they've, you know, to their credit, they were able to move and replace that
eventually.
But, yeah, eventually, it took time, and so I think a lot of these things, it's interesting. I agree with you. I think WWC is going to be fascinating this year, because Apple, even though they did, you know, they moved it to San Jose a couple years ago, and you know, they've made some changes here and there, this forces them to really just like rethink everything, the whole thing, you know, stem to stern. And I think that's going to be fascinating, because we are all very used to these extremely formulaic, extremely well-oiled machines of how these kinds of like product introductions and platform discussions and how those all work. And you can't run the same playbook.
Yeah.
It just isn't possible. So, hey, use this as I think you're right. It's an opportunity. It's a big opportunity for them to rethink how they do things, hopefully for the better.
All right. Well, people who want to hear us talk about your book and what's going on with that should tune into this weekend's episode of The Incomparable, where we're going to talk about it.
Yeah.
Literally right after we do this, we're going to talk about it. And then that'll be this weekend's
segue
episode.
Segue directly in.
Yeah, pretty much. So we'll do that. Thank you all for being subscribers. John Gruber and Ben Thompson launched a subscriber podcast this week, which is very exciting. I look forward to seeing John hit that 15-minute mark. That's like 3 weeks of the talk show, or 3 weeks of this show is a talk show. So that's, I got it reversed. But anyway, welcome to them.
Keep watching that clock, John.
Yeah, welcome to them, because as you all know, we've been doing that for a couple of years now. Ha ha ha. How many episodes would you say we've done of this?
Of this show?
Yeah.
I lost track because we didn't start it. It didn't start when the blog started.
Right.
It started a while after that.
And I stopped numbering them.
Well, that's on you, man.
I stopped numbering them.
You could probably get a count of the feed somewhere.
I can tell you exactly. The answer is this is episode number 194.
No, okay. I can't do math.
194.
Oh, we got into 200th coming up, huh?
We do.
About WWDC time, about 6 weeks from now.
Awesome.
Nailed it.
Well, until next week, dear subscribers, thank you. And Dan, goodbye.
Keep watching the clock, Jason.